So, you know, if you're thinking in terms of this, you might think that, yes, I'm a professional investment, I'm an investment professional. So surely my own house should be most in order. But I think like with so many other professions, unless you actually consciously engage and pay attention to it, you are easily going to fall into exactly the same traps as other people.
Have you ever wondered about how we make decisions about our money? Or why we feel the way we do about those decisions? Welcome to Nudging Financial Behavior, the podcast that aims to help you understand how and why you make certain decisions about money. Presented by Dr. Giselle Willows, an expert in behavioral finance. This podcast is all about looking at human behavior and biases, especially when it comes to your finances. You can catch the series on YouTube, the Nudging Financial Behavior blog, or on your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to like and subscribe to ensure you don't miss an episode. Special thanks to our sponsor, IG Markets South Africa, a world-leading online trading provider that gives you access to opportunities across thousands of financial markets through their intuitive platforms and apps. Let's get started.
And here we are, the final episode of season two. I'm Dr. Giselle Willows, and in case you didn't catch the name yet, this is the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast. I'd like to take a moment to say a special thank you to our sponsor for seasons one and two, IG Markets South Africa. We couldn't have done this without you. In this episode, we're going to recap everything that we discussed this season, starting with risk aversion and loss aversion. We also looked at the disposition effect, as well as availability bias, the primacy effect, recency bias, and home bias. We covered a lot. Before we jump in though, please hit the like and subscribe buttons. Just like we did in the last season, I asked all of my guests from this season about their biggest financial mistakes. It's a fascinating question to ask, and it reminds us that we're all human. We can all make financial mistakes. And I thought this would be the perfect way to kick off the final episode.
For 10 years in the UK, we've had near zero interest rates, and we all got very used to it. And it came almost 2 years ago to when I needed to have my mortgage renewed. And what I should have been thinking is, actually, mortgage rates can't get very much better because they can't go very much lower, but they can get a lot worse. And of course, we weren't thinking through, you know, invasions of Ukraine, etc. And instead of doing the sensible thing and locking in a low rate for the next 5 years, I just went for the two-year one, and I'm about to have a mortgage payments multiply by six in a few months.
Well, I'd have to say it was opening up an overdraft facility on my account, because now I can't get up from under it. I've never had overdraft facilities before, and now I don't know what money's mine and what money's not mine, what money I owe. I just can't figure it out. It's always confusing, and the money. So that overdraft facility has been a killer, and I just can't seem to get away from it.
I'm not even sure that it was a decision. It was when I was a young, brand new employee, my first job. I was all of 22 years old, fresh out of varsity, and I was sold life insurance. Now, if I think in terms of when and why one needs life insurance, a 22-year-old with no debt and with no dependents and with no nothing, why should you have life insurance? So looking back on that, I think maybe that was, and I mean, I wasn't in the financial industry at all at the time, but I think it planted a seed in terms of this idea of investments or financial decisions being sold to people, rather than you as an informed investor buying something that you know you need. And I think that might have also planted the seeds of my passion for financial education, that I want people to know why they are investing in something, why they're buying something, because I think it also assists a lot in terms of how we evaluate the success or the effectiveness of what we've done.
Having children. No, in all seriousness, look, children are financially they take a lot, but in all seriousness, I love my kids. I've made lots of financial mistakes, plenty. The most recent one I've made is I bought a classic Mercedes Benz, and that thing is just a money pit. So that's my most recent poor financial decision.
sorry, Garth. I hope your kids aren't listening to this podcast. I think what we can learn from this is that financial mistakes aren't always big moments in your life. They come in all shapes and sizes, and sometimes they're not really mistakes. They're just a change in personal circumstances, and that leads to financial issues. The goal here is to be aware of how easy these mistakes are to make and to do your best to ensure you have sufficient savings to cover you in rough times. This leads me quite nicely onto something I chatted to Christia from Hearden about.
And so this is what I'm saying. Nothing about personal finances is super difficult. The concept is super difficult, but how you pull those things together. So let's say you pull interest rates with something like compounding. Okay. Again, compounding, you know, it's not a difficult concept to understand. And people keep explaining compounding like, oh, you have to understand it's money on the money that you've already made. And it's like, yeah, we get it. That's what compounding is. But compounding also has a negative side. So if you have debt, debt also compounds. Okay. So you are paying interest on debt. So now you've got two mutual things that have a positive and a negative impact on your finances. And do you understand how those things all work together to impact your finances? And once you understand that, suddenly you can make better choices. And that's actually all you're wanting to do. Managing your money is just about making the best choice with the information that you have.
Okay, let's jump into our recap for the season. We started with a big conversation around risk aversion and loss aversion. This actually covered half the season because they're both biases that play a massive part in our financial decision-making. We focused a lot on trading and investing with these two biases because that's where you see them playing out in a strong way. But that doesn't mean that they don't impact those of you who aren't trading or investing. Of course, and I have to go back to talking about investing because the term risk is something we use in investing all the time. A riskier trade is one that has great potential for a big gain, but it also has the potential for a big loss in the same time frame. So with this notion of a risky investment comes the term risk tolerance. This refers to how much risk you're able to handle in your investments. Assessing risk tolerance is something that many financial planners will spend time on when they meet with a client. It's something that people should always try to have a handle on, but it's important to remember that your risk tolerance can change over time. Let's have a listen to our experts about what they have to say about their own risk tolerance.
Sure, I think my risk tolerance was an evolving journey. So started off very much risk averse and actually had some robust conversations when I first made my initial investments with some friends. They were like, oh, you're young, Shreya, you can stand to lose some money. And I thought, not a chance, this is my, you know, first ever salary, my first ever proper pay slip. I don't want to let this money go. So I invested way too conservatively. But I think as I gained experience, as I managed to more effectively translate my conceptual financial knowledge into practice, became way more risk tolerant. I just need to understand the investment before I put my money down. Do I understand Bitcoin? My money's not going there. But do I have a better understanding of equity and, you know, high-risk funds? What's sitting in a fund? If I'm comfortable with that, then I can proceed. So better risk tolerance now than before, yeah.
Yeah, so interestingly, my risk tolerance actually is not that high, and it's become less over the years. I used to be far more risk-seeking as a youngster, but I think as you become older, your responsibilities grow, you have family, you have more to lose. And I guess as you get more advanced through life, your risk tolerance should actually decline. So at this point, my risk tolerance is not very high. I actually don't like losing money much, which is strange for a trader to say that. I mean, I understand trading is, losing money is a natural part of trading, but I'm very much controlled in terms of how much I'm willing to lose on an individual trade. And I'm accepting of that. But I also come from a background where we had a lot of financial difficulty growing up. So in our household growing up, there was always financial challenges. And that has very much shaped the way I look at money and the way I look at finances. So as a consequence, I don't want to put my family through financial hardship. And as a consequence of that, I guess my tolerance for risk has come down quite a bit over the years.
And I can say with quite a bit of confidence that I am a high risk tolerance individual. I don't mind taking risks in all sorts of areas. Where does it come from? I don't know. I do think that some of this is fundamental personality, as you know, you can be born more extrovert or introvert, and I think a lot of that does come out in risk tolerance. There's a fair amount of evidence that culture also matters, and what's around you. If you grow up in a riskier environment, you're often baseline levels of the risk that you're willing to take are simply higher. In my case, I grew up in a family where my father was an entrepreneur and had three small businesses fail on him one after another and just kept plowing on. And it was kind of in the family's DNA in that sense. So that may also have been a strong contributing factor.
One of the things that I've learned about from behavioral psychologists is that risk tolerance is an oversimplified concept, that we really need to understand what our risk appetite is depending on the circumstances in which we find ourselves. So you can sort of talk about a general propensity, but honestly, in some cases, I find that I'm quite conservative. And in some instances, I take quite wild risks. At least my wife thinks they're wild. But I think that a lot depends on what the situation is. When I'm conservative, I can tell you that loss aversion usually plays a significant role. It's not so much the risk of an unfavorable outcome is really feeling lousy about losing. If I think I might lose and I might feel terrible about it, then I'll just shy away from taking risk. So it's loss aversion more than risk aversion.
See what I mean about risk tolerance not being set in stone and how there are so many elements that influence our personal tolerance levels. Context and experience play a big part. I also want to point out that having a lower risk tolerance isn't necessarily a bad thing. You can still reap high rewards from investing. You just need to adjust your strategy to accommodate your personal level. Loss aversion was also something we discussed in detail this season. The terms loss aversion and risk aversion are often used interchangeably, but this is wrong. They're quite different biases and can impact our financial decisions in different ways. Loss aversion is when you place more emphasis on a loss than a gain of the same value. Remember prospect theory and the graph we looked at? When you're not loss averse, your S-curve on the graph will be symmetrical. For example, a loss of 100 will take you 1 point down on the y-axis, and a gain of 100 will take you 1 point up. Now, when you are loss averse, this S-curve is not symmetrical. You'll see a much deeper curve below the x-axis on the loss side than you'll see above it. For example, a gain of 100 will take you that same 1 point up, while a loss of 100 will take you maybe 2 points down. As you can see, there's a lot of emotion that comes with investing and making financial decisions. A lot of what we cover in this podcast is really about managing those emotions. Figure out how to ensure that your rational brain wins out when making choices about your money. Of course, that's easier said than done, I know. I asked my guests how they manage their emotional anxiety.
Well, I was going to say, what makes you think I do manage them? My preferred approach is just to wake up at 3 a.m. and worry for a couple of hours.
I work harder. So if I know I've spent money I shouldn't have spent, it's actually a motivator. I work that much harder the next week.
But again, I've recognized that I am definitely in the category of people who is probably a bit sensitive to uncertainty and risk, maybe gets those feelings of anxiety about making those decisions. And I think in finance and in general, the planning, the preparation, the research is a coping strategy to manage that to enable me then to make a decision at the end. So yeah, planning, preparation, research is my go-to coping.
So I think one of my favorite analogies is one of being on a boat on the open sea. And because I've had a couple of experiences where I got quite seasick. And so I would think to myself, how do I react on a boat on the choppy sea if I'm feeling nauseous? Because let's face it, that's pretty much what happens when when there's lots of volatility in markets in particular. And so I take myself to the place where I imagine walking out onto the deck of the boat where there is a breeze that I can feel on my face and looking towards the horizon. Because it's when you look down on into the choppy waters immediately beneath you that you get even sicker and that you feel more violently nauseous. Whereas if you look towards the horizon where things appear a lot more calm, it's as though that soothes my nerves and say, it's okay, it's okay. And then there's the silly little thing that says, everything will be okay in the end. So if it's not okay, it's not the end.
I love that. If it's not okay, it's not the end. And that's the truth of the matter with investing. The market is volatile, meaning it goes through ups and downs every day, every week. But in the long run, in the end, it goes up. After we wrapped up talking about risk and loss aversion, not that you can ever really divorce those two from the rest, we focused on three biases that are about when information is given to you. These are availability bias, the primacy effect, and recency bias. Availability bias is an interesting one. Essentially, it's when you assign a high probability of something happening to you, even though the actual probability is low or non-existent. We do this when certain information becomes readily available and is easy to recall in our minds. Remember the paragliding example? My friends were suddenly highly concerned that I might have an accident when I jumped off the mountain because there had been a fatal accident in the months before I went. The accident was very sad, but it didn't increase my chances of having an accident at all. What changed was the availability of the information about the accident. Then we looked at the primacy effect, which is all about first impressions. They really do count. And it goes further than dressing well for a job interview. The order in which you list things can make a difference in how people perceive what you're describing. The impact of this bias is that the first piece of information you hear about something becomes the most important piece of information. And this could easily sway the decision you make. We also looked at recency bias. It's similar, but a little different. While the primacy effect looks at the first item on the list, recency bias is actually about the last piece of information you heard. It all depends on how close together the information comes at you. A grocery list? You'll remember the first couple of items you read. But big news events? You'll remember the most recent story that you heard rather than historic events that are related. Thinking about recency bias and the impact of the news and social media on our decision making, I asked our guests about their news consumption habits.
I'm not quite as bad as a serial scroller. I've gotten a lot better since Twitter became X, and I don't know. It seems the whole dialogue on there seems to have changed, and I found myself naturally losing interest in it. I used to be far more engaged with Twitter than was possibly healthy for any individual. And not to say it's these things aren't sometimes a good source of news, and very often they're a good source of entertainment, but they're very seldom the best use of your time. Given the other things you can do with it, you know, spend time with your family, read a book, go and do some exercise. So I would say I'm much more controlled on my financial behavior than my social media behavior, sadly.
I love the news. So I subscribe to quite a few financial newsletters, and I subscribe to a lot of local news channels. So I love reading the news in the morning. I systematically digest everything that has happened. I think about which key pieces will affect my, you know, my daily job in the short, medium to long term, and then I'm done. So I have a set time in the day to read the news. I reflect on the consequence it has for me as a person, me and my occupation, and then I close it for the day. I'm not a serial scroller when it comes to the news. Very lucky there.
So I tend to almost categorize different types of social media also for different purposes. And so I think of something like X, formerly known as Twitter. For me, it really is like a radar. I like that form of social media because it allows me to see quite quickly what's out there and then to choose which of those articles or posts or whatever I engage with. Now, what's really crucial there is that you identify quite well who it is that you follow, so that you are exposed to the type of content providers that give you the sort of information that you're looking for.
I'm not a serial scroller. I'm very careful with social media. Now, I'll tell you, a lot of it has to do with opportunity cost. There are a lot of things I want to work on. And if I get caught up in social media, it takes time away from doing the things that I really want to do. So I don't find it addictive. But many people do find it addictive. So I'm a bit different from others, I think, in that respect.
I'm very happy that they all spoke about putting boundaries in place and that we shouldn't completely throw out social media. It does have its place in our news and information consumption. Finally, we looked at home bias in the previous two episodes. With this bias, we show a tendency towards things that are local or more familiar. In investing, this means buying shares in local companies and usually failing to have a properly diversified investment portfolio. A well-diversified investment portfolio is extremely important. If you let home bias win, you could end up with some serious problems. This is why I asked my guests, most of them financial experts themselves, how they go about assessing their own portfolios.
So, you know, if you think in terms of this, you might think that, yes, I'm an investment professional. So surely my own house should be most in order. But I think like with so many other professions, unless you actually consciously engage and pay attention to it, you are easily going to fall into exactly the same traps as other people. So I love this time of year when, you know, whether it's New Year's resolutions about, you know, my character or my diet or my whatever it might be, that we also have this discipline of an annual portfolio review, taking stock. It's not just about where my portfolio is, but to also take stock of my objectives, my goals. What is it that I'm trying to achieve? And therefore to always ensure that my portfolio is not just positioned for my goals, but that it is diversified enough to also withstand the inevitable volatility that we're going to experience in markets.
Yeah, so I think I am relatively well diversified. I track all of my assets on a spreadsheet, and then I've put them into a pie chart. So just visually looking at that, you can look at the pie chart and you can see if one piece of the pie is too big or too small. And I track that constantly. And I think that for me as a visual representation helps to know whether I'm well diversified or not. And that's a method that's quite simple to do. Anyone can put a spreadsheet together and track their assets and check that they're well diversified. And it's something I'd highly recommend that people do.
To really diversify well in a portfolio that you're picking and choosing stocks, you should do a little research. You want to be choosing, you know, stocks or securities that are in different market sectors. They're likely not to track each other too closely.
Oh, that's easy. I use a financial planner. So I don't just manage my own portfolio 100%, although I have a lot of input. So I rely on low-cost ETFs and mutual funds that are well-constructed by a really high quality optimizing engine and monitor it so that it's, you know, stays within a reasonable bounds by, you know, in engaging and rebalancing intermittently if that's what's required.
Ladies and gentlemen, if Hirsch Schifrin can use a financial planner to help him with his portfolio, everyone should be using one. Getting that outside eye to evaluate and help you take your personal emotions out of the equation is invaluable. And we're just about at the end of the last episode of season two. But before we go, I have one last question that I asked my guests, and the answers were pretty interesting. There is some great humor in this group. So the current stat is that 70% of traders lose money. I asked my guests why they think that is.
I think there's a number of reasons why that might be. One could be as simple as skill. So not being skillful enough, so not having good market knowledge or product knowledge, or even having a well-tested, developed process, which is the core foundation for me anyway. So that, I think that's a big factor for many. Tied into that maybe is experience, not having enough experience to extract money from the market on an ongoing basis. Three, I would say, is probably psychological. So we, you know very well, I know very well, there are a whole number of challenges to making financial decisions generally, let alone in the markets with high levels of risk and uncertainty, ambiguity, the stresses and pressures that come with dealing with the outcomes. So, and I think, sadly, a lot of people in that retail space get into it for probably for good reasons, or they get sucked into it with some mis-selling of kind of how hard or how challenging it really is. I think it's a bit seductive trading because it looks like it's relatively easy, and it's often sold that way by people that are maybe the educators, and it feels like it could be easy in terms of the sort of the knowledge base. But those of us involved in that world know actually to be good at it, you've got to be very skillful, very knowledgeable, and it takes time.
I don't know why a lot of traders think they aren't going to lose money, because you're trying to make a whole lot of very short-term decisions in a way that is likely to trigger all of these biases and emotional states that we've been talking about, and a whole raft more besides. I think to trade effectively and trade well, you need to put in place a whole lot of safety checks and balances and ways in which you can control your behavior. Even just understanding your own financial personality at the outset and having really good self-awareness is almost a necessary precursor. And I think a lot of people trade for the wrong reasons. They go in and they trade because it's excited, because it excites them, or they trade because they, I don't know, it's the chance of a quick win, etc. To really be a good trader requires a huge amount of control and preparation. And I think fewer than 30% of actual traders have put in the work that they need to be doing it properly.
It's like a carnival. You go to a carnival and they have these little games where you just have to pick up a ball and throw it and knock something over and win a prize. And it looks so easy, a set of milk bottles in front of you, you throw it. Well, when you actually do it, you find, wow, it's a lot harder than it looks. You get sucked in, you pay your money, and you don't win a big prize at the end. You win a booby prize if you're lucky. It's a lot harder than it looks. And sentiment is like that. Sentiment's a lot harder to predict than it seems. It's seductive, but it gets you. It manipulates you. And so many traders are induced to engage in non-profitable trading behaviors because they're fun to do. And they are induced, they're really manipulated. So platforms play to people's self-image and egos and vanity and get them to engage in behavior by telling them that they're smart. And this is what smart people do. When really what's happening is that they're turning wealth over to somebody else who's manipulating for that purpose.
Giselle, I think it's because the majority of traders aren't women.
I do love Shreya's girl power, and she may have a point there. But in all seriousness, it's important to know that losing money is part of trading. It just doesn't need to be the overriding fact of trading. I really hope this podcast is helping you manage your emotions when trading. It's all about having a plan, systems, processes, and you might just end up gaining more financially than you lose. So that really is it for season 2 of the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I really hope you found our discussions on biases interesting and helpful. When you're aware of them, you can take steps to prevent them from interfering with your decision-making process. And thank you to IG Markets South Africa for sponsoring this podcast. We couldn't ask for a better partner to get our message out there. Don't forget to like this episode and hit the subscribe button to hear about new content on the channel. See you soon.
That was Nudging Financial Behavior, hosted by behavioral finance expert, Dr. Giselle Willows. Make sure you like and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. You can catch the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast on YouTube, our blog, or your favorite podcast streaming platform. Thank you again to our sponsors, IG Markets South Africa, for helping to bring the show to life. And now for the disclaimer. This podcast should not be seen as advice. All the information and opinions are of a general nature. They are not intended to address the needs or circumstances of any individual. We are not financial advisors, neither are any of our staff or service providers, nor is our sponsor. All expressions of opinion by the host or guest are subject to change without notice in reaction to shifting market conditions. Any information you get from us should be seen as only that, information only.